Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello and welcome to Your Booked, a Shelf Isolation special. Before I introduce this week's guest, Claire McIntosh, I would like to ask podcast listeners to support some important causes if you're able to do so. In the show notes, we'll include links for the Minnesota Freedom Fund, Stop Hate UK and Rachel Cargill's Great Unlearn project. This is obviously a tiny fraction of the organisations we need to support who are doing vital work in the wake of George Floyd's death. I've started reading Leila F. Saad's book, Mean White Supremacy, How to Recognise Your Privilege, Combat Racism and Change the World, and I'll include a link to that too. Thank you. Now today we're shelf isolating with the prolific Claire McIntosh, author of several brilliant books from her debut, I Let You Go, to After the End, her latest book. Now Claire is as passionate about reading as she is about writing. We talked about the book she broke into a house for, literary misadventures in Paris, and her surprise career as a librarian. So you are finding that you're sort of gravitating towards the things that are a bit like these times.
Yeah, a little bit, although I'm doing what I always do, which is needing a palate cleanse between sort of difficult or stressful or heavy books. And so I'm flitting madly between completely psychotic thrillers to a Jilly Cooper or a Katie Ford or something. So my reading tastes, which have always been eclectic, are even more eclectic now.
So these are all books that would be surprised to find themselves sat next to each other at a dinner party, and yet there they are sat.
Yeah, they are. And you know, so I keep my, so I, all my books are in front of me. I've got a whole wall of shelves, floor to ceiling shelves, and they're filed alphabetically because that's, I just have to have things in some kind of order. But what I love about alphabetical filing is that completely inappropriate authors are next to each other, whereas I think if I was designing a bookshelf by the way it looked, it would probably end up with much more suitable bedfellows. But I rather like the fact that authors are cheek by jowl with people that probably they would never sit round a table with.
So what are you reading at the moment?
Can I tell, I'm gonna look at my reading book to tell you. I started writing, keeping a journal of reading books. So every year I have one of these blue notebooks, A5 blue notebooks, which are really, really cheap and not beautiful at all, but I used to use them in the police and I really missed them. So I use them now for my reading journals, and I star things that I loved. And so I can tell you that the last book that I read that completely blew me away was My Dark Vanessa. Have you read it?
Yes. Yes, tell me about it.
So it's been on my radar to read for ages. And actually I was sent a copy quite early on. And then my neighbour said, we were messaging about whether we had any yeast or flour, which is pretty much what my conversations with my neighbours have been recently. And he said that he was reading it. And I thought, oh, brilliant, I'll do that. And I was gardening a lot at the time, so I downloaded it on audiobook. And I just spent 3 full days in the garden listening to My Dark Vanessa. And every now and again, I just have to sink back on my heels from my reading and just listen to her voice, because the narrator is outstanding. She's so skilled.
Do you know who it is? Is it an actor that we know, or just someone who's reading out the book really well?
I could not tell you. It is an actor who doesn't normally do audiobooks, because at the end she gave a really brilliant interview about the process of doing an audiobook and inhabiting that character and being both ages, which must have been a real challenge. But I just thought it was so brilliantly written, uncomfortable to listen to read as a story, but so important.
Because I imagine, because I read it in the traditional paper way, and that was intense. But to have that story, that voice in your ears, I imagine that adds a whole extra sort of dimension of intensity and claustrophobia to it.
Oh, I think so, completely. The last time I felt like that about an audiobook was Jodi Picoult's Small Great Things. I'm looking to make sure I've got the title right. Small Great Things, which is the one about the racist parents in a maternity unit. Have you read this? Where the parents refused to be looked after by a black nurse. And it's got some incredibly uncomfortable language in it. And of course, when you're listening to that and having that language and those terms in your ear, it is properly shocking. But that's why she wrote the book. You know, that it needs to be shocking for it to have the impact that it should have.
Mm. You know, I remember Jodi Picoult being a writer that I sort of had a lot of preconceptions about, and then actually reading her, I had all of those preconceptions kind of turned on their head. Her sort of that writing a really, really arresting social commentary, but also finding humanity in every single person, no matter what their views are or how abhorrent they are.
Yeah, I think she's really skilled. I read A Spark of Light recently, and I listened to her talk at a bookshop in the UK last year, and she's so brilliant and so passionate about the issues that she's writing about. But I think she's particularly skilled in making you sympathize with the baddies, in essence, you know, the people who are doing terrible things, of getting you under their skin, which is a real skill as a writer.
Something I was wondering is, in these times, are there any characters from books that you think would be great fun to be looked down with? And is there anyone you've met in a book who you think would be hellish to be looked down in? Because you mentioned Jilly Cooper. I was thinking about, I don't know, one of the romances, Imogen, and the couple who they go on holiday with them, James and Imogen. And I think Yvonne from Imogen would be one of my top three worst lockdown nightmares.
Worst lockdowns. I think my... So interestingly, there is someone from a Jilly Cooper who I would happily be locked down with. A slightly unusual choice, perhaps. But Taggy Campbell Black, so Rupert's second wife, because I've always adored her anyway, and she's so utterly lovely. I seem to remember she bakes, she cooks brilliantly. She could homeschool my kids in a way that I am failing spectacularly. So, you know, maybe not huge fun, although I think she is quite fun, but just a lovely person to be locked down with. But people I would hate, Pollyanna.
Oh, good one.
Because much as I love, and I really do love Pollyanna, can you just imagine how irritating it would be to have that endless positivity? You know, the kind of, we've got no loo roll. Oh, but aren't we blessed to have a working bowel? I would not be able. I'd kill her, I think. So she's my anti-lockdown heroine.
Oh, I found myself getting into a fight with someone on Twitter the other day because of Cousin Helen, and they were talking about how insufferable Cousin Helen is from what Katie did. And I felt quite like, but I think, you know, she's quite steely. I think she'd have the fortitude for this that a lot of us don't. But also, yes, sometimes you want someone who's going to make the best of things, and sometimes you want someone to say, well, no, this is awful.
Yeah, I think it's smugness that's hard to take. It's, you know, positivity is one thing, but insufferable smugness is difficult.
When someone talks about a smug character in a book, I always think about Pooja from Diary of a Nobody, who's smug but very insecure in that smugness. But I think he'd lose it pretty quickly. I think, you know, the first week definitely. He's becoming unravelled. I was like, what was the first book that you remember reading that made you think, oh, this is reading and it's just for me and this isn't a parent or teacher or someone giving me this?
It's an unusual choice. I've never come across anybody who loved these books the way that I loved them. I've got one here, even though I know we're a podcast, because I want to think that you're walking around my house looking at my books. So this is one of my old copies of Just William. And I was trying to remember how I discovered Just William, but it was a passion that started when I was probably about 10 and didn't come from school. I don't think my parents knew. I don't really know, but I bought one and absolutely loved them. And then my pocket money for just months was spent on building up the whole series. And I took them to university with me. I started collecting old ones that I found in shops. And I just love, I think it came down to the characterization. So I suppose previously to that, like a lot of my peers, I'd read a lot of Famous Fives. And again, the Famous Five are just a little bit too, they're a bit smug. A bit perfect.
A bit 2D, aren't they? You can't really tell the difference between you're either a girl or a girl who's a bit boyish and that's okay, or a dog.
Yes, completely. And in Just William, Richmal Crompton has created such well-rounded characters, the adults and the kids, and they're so cleverly plotted because the adults are having their own stories that you sort of dip in and out of from William's perspective. And they're just brilliant. They're funny and they're fast-paced and they're really, really tight stories. And I adore them, but nobody else I know really has had such an obsession with them or continues to read them as an adult.
I was just going to ask that. Do you read them still? Do you retake? Because I love the idea that you took them to university as maybe something when you would need comfort of...
So these are my comfort reads. These are my literary equivalents of the Heinz tomato soup that I have when I'm feeling a bit meh. I read them now, have them in all sorts of different formats, have the audio stories. They're just brilliant.
That edition that you just showed me, which I'll describe to the listeners, this being a podcast, it's a beautiful hardback and it still has a dust jacket and it looks like an original. Is that a first edition? And is that one that you've had for a while?
This particular one, I've got two that are quite similar. This one was a gift. My parents gave me this on my 18th birthday and it had £100 within its pages in £10 notes, sort of, you know, slipped in. Oh, I've just found postcards in it.
I thought you were going to say you found another tenner.
The pages. I thought I was going to find a £10 note, but I haven't. I've just found two very old photographs, but I've got no idea who they're of. This one's of a lady with her dog sitting by a beach somewhere. And this one is rather inexplicably just of a German Shepherd dog. But I don't think they're mine. I think they belonged within the pages of this book. Anyway, so it was an 18th birthday present. That was originally 3 and 6 it cost, and it's a second edition. Clearly I wasn't worth the first edition.
Are there any books where either for yourself or as a present you've either splashed out on a first edition or gone and thought, oh, it'd be so lovely to get them a first edition and be like, oh, it's £100,000, I might not.
Do you know, I never have. No, I never have. I love secondhand books, but I'm not interested in the value of them or the cachet. I like the feel of them. I like them if they're a bit tatty and if they smell a bit and if they're slightly mildewed. I've got a book actually over there that I stole. In fact, I'm going to get it because I haven't looked at it for ages. Hang on. say stole. I didn't really stole. I rescued it. I rescued it from a house that had been abandoned, and we climbed in through a broken window, and it was completely empty and sort of derelict. And there was a pile of very, very mildewy books on the floor.
Was this, was this when you were with the police? Was this a...
No. I was a child. Oh. I wouldn't have stolen books as a police officer.
I thought maybe you'd gone in to check the abandoned house and the books were there and they were, you know, is that or the evidence locker?
No. So I would have been about 15, I think. And there are, I've got maybe four or five from that stash. Anyway, this particular one, which is the first one I've picked up, is a guidebook called A Traveller in Rome by H.V. Morton. And it's got lovely maps on the inside. So the end papers have just got really beautiful illustrated maps. And I don't think I had a particular interest in Rome. But it was just very lovely, and it was rotting. And so I like that. I like to make sure that books are looked after and given a home. And I've kept a lot of old books that I was given, or that were in the family home, and I felt perhaps needed to be loved a bit more. They've ended up with me.
So you have a sort of, it's a book sanctuary.
A book, yes, a home for retired books, yes. Some of them are very tatty. I'd love to do a book binding course or learn how to repair. I've got this lovely book, this Edward Lear book of nonsense poems, but look, the spine is all tatty and falling off. I don't know when that dates from. So it's got an inscription, M.M. Melder or Meldum, it's not a family name, Christmas 1932, that was given to them. And then I have written in my seven-year-old hand my own name, together with my little pink angel stamp that I inexplicably put in all my books. But it's very tatty, but very brilliant and full of lots of poems like The Pobble Who Has No Toes, who swam across the Bristol Channel.
It's such a beautiful edition. These covers are something really evocative. You get that sense of books as tactile objects and sort of lovely to have, as well as lovely for what's inside them.
Yes, they are. I particularly love those books. I don't know what the technical term for it is, but the ones that are covered in something that feels like fabric. Is it board? They board covers? Anyway, those are lovely.
I wanted to ask you about your little library, which I've just been reading about. Tell us all about it and how it started.
I mean, so lots of people do this, is the first thing to say. This is not something sort of special. I have a lot of books. I do like to keep books, but I also like to share books and pass them on. And I am very passionate about championing the accessibility of books, both in terms of the sorts of books that I talk about, but also in terms of physical access to books. And libraries are brilliant, as we know, and I'm very lucky that we have a really good local authority library in the town where I live. But they actually are sometimes still intimidating for people. You have to walk in, you have to get a library card, you worry about whether you'll be judged about what you're taking out or how long it's going to take you to read it. There are lots of worries related to formal spaces like that. And so I wanted to put a library box at the end of my drive. And we had a friend building a treehouse in the garden at the time. And I said, have you got any wood that you can spare? And I'll try and knock up a box. He said, leave it with me. And he built me what looks like a fairy house. It's much bigger than I had intended. And it lives at the end of my drive. And I called it the secret library. And I put books in it. I put proofs that I'm sent that I keep for about a year until after the book has come out. So, you know, the publication day, and then several months after that, I might put the proof in the box. And some books that I love and have multiple copies of and feel I could let go. And then of course, people in the community will share their books. And it's a book swap box. It's not complicated. And since lockdown, it's been used so much more than usual. So the turnover is really high, new books borrowed all the time. And I noticed that some children's books were appearing. We've not normally had children's books because there isn't that much room. But that was a great thing to think that children were starting to use it as well during lockdown, obviously as part of their daily exercise. And a local teacher said, would you like me to build you an extension? And so he built me a children's department, which sits underneath my secret library. And now we have children's books there as well. And the children's section is carpeted. It's a cupboard. It's just your hand that's going in. But it just feels like a children's classroom. It's lovely.
Are there any books that you have donated to the little library and then thought, oh no, hold on, I'd quite like that back actually?
That's a brilliant question. Not me, but my son. None of my children like giving their books away, but my son in particular, he's 13 and a voracious reader and would really like to keep all his books. I had a bit of a clear out. This actually was ages ago, before lockdown. I had a bit of a clear out and put some sort of older kids' books out, and he was not very pleased at all. So yeah, he doesn't want to get rid of any of his books.
What were the books, can you remember, that he was keen to get back, or did he just want them to be a completist?
No, because that's the thing, is it's not about the individual titles. It's just the sense that they're his books and they make up a part of his history, you know, that they are the books that built him. And yeah, he struggles to let go of them. Whereas I'm a bit more relaxed, actually. I do keep the books that I love, but I also I'm happy. You know, I will lend books out knowing that some people might not give them back, because I think, well, they still exist. You know, the stories still exist. I can borrow those books again. I can buy those books again.
I don't know if I've got much more relaxed about it. If someone borrows a book and they forget to give it back, or they lend it to someone else, it's just it's a nice way of making space for a new book. And also that now there are so many more ways to listen. And if I get really, really desperate, there are a number of times I've been writing something, wanted to refer to a book. I know I've got the book, as I have a physical copy of it, and I either can't find it or I can find it, but not the bit I'm after. And so I also get the Kindle so I can go and search.
Yes, and I've had a couple of books that I've really enjoyed that I have listened to on audio at the same time as reading the book, because my schedule at the time meant that I was doing a lot of driving. And so I would drive to wherever I was going and listen to the audiobook, and then that evening when I was in my hotel room or wherever, I'd pick up the paperback and carry on reading it. And I quite like that sort of movement between formats.
I think, yeah, it's a different kind of intimacy, isn't it? I've never done that, but that makes me want to. It's a different way of having a conversation, because I think reading always feels like a conversation of sorts.
Yeah, it does. And in the same way that you move a conversation, you know, from the phone to the pub or whatever. I think it's fine to flit between formats. I remember being on holiday when I was reading Life After Life, and I dropped it in the swimming pool, and it was absolutely irretrievably damaged. And so I bought it on Kindle instantly, and within half an hour was reading the rest of it on my phone, because I was so distraught that I hadn't been able to finish this book on holiday. So the flexibility and the accessibility now is just phenomenal.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites.
So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
We'll be back to Claire soon, but I'd like to recommend a book that feels appropriate to this moment. The Good Immigrant, edited by podcast guest Nikesh Shukla, is an essay collection in which 21 different writers reflect on experiencing racism, cultural othering, and what it means to make a home in a place where you encounter prejudiced people who make you feel as though you don't belong. This is one of the most thought-provoking books I've ever read. It's funny, it's shocking, it's heartbreaking, moving and infuriating. It reminds me that I have plenty of work to do and that I want to live in a world where everyone can move freely, speak freely and write freely. The Good Immigrant is published by Unbound. Now, back to Claire. I wanted to ask you, talking about children's books, whether there are any books that you have read to your children, that your children have discovered, that you wish, in a way, you could have perhaps gone back and read those when you were their age.
Gosh, loads, really loads. I read recently Asher and the Spirit Bird, and it's absolutely brilliant. And I read it twice because I wanted to read it with, Jasbinder Bilan. I read it on my own, first of all, and then I wanted to read it to my children to see what it's like, because again, it's a different conversation. I read it then with my daughter, and she loved it just as much as I did. And I think books like that one in particular, which is really rich in terms of culture, is so important to introduce children to different worlds. Whereas I look back at the books that I read, you know, again, the Famous Five, Just William, one of my absolute favourites was Swallows and Amazons as a child. They were all very, very middle class, very white middle class, bubble, safe, lovely children. And the books that I'm reading now with my kids and that they're reading are so much broader in terms of the world that they're exploring and the demographics, the people, the issues. I think it's fantastic.
I think what you were saying about accessibility, and that's, you know, it's often a physical thing, isn't it, with libraries, but also I think that if you don't do, or if you perhaps come to it later, it can be very daunting at first to think, oh gosh, I'm reading about a world that's completely different from my own and completely outside my own. And if you, the earlier you start doing that, the more general enthusiasm for reading you have and the more comfortable you are traversing all of those spaces.
Yes, definitely. And I suspect actually that here is somewhere that television has worked really well, because children's TV programs are much broader now in scope, and children are seeing their own worlds on TV in a way that they wouldn't have done 10, 15 years ago. And that's then making it much more comfortable for kids to explore those worlds in book form, because they're used to seeing those pictures and those characters.
I think that's a really good point. Are there any books that you love that you would love to see adapted for the screen, either film or TV?
I find that sort of thing really hard because I don't watch huge amounts of TV and I actively often avoid adaptations. I'm going to watch Normal People. I'm going to watch Normal People, but only because I haven't read the book yet and I have a feeling I might not, so I'm just going to watch it. Whereas normally I try and avoid adaptations because I just don't think they're ever very good. One of the odd exceptions being Bridget Jones, which I hated in book form and love so much on screen, and just think it is, I just think it's better. I think it's better. I find diary format really hard to read. In any novel, actually, it's a device that's used quite a lot, and I just find it very stilted and difficult to get into the narrative. So yeah, it worked better on TV. But no, there's nothing that I'm really kind of hanging out for. I'd always rather have the book.
What do you think was different about book Bridget and screen Bridget? Was it sort of her character or her world that you...
No, it wasn't the story. It wasn't the character. It was purely the way it was presented. The having those diary entries exactly the same, you know, here's the date, weight, whatever, cigarette smoked, you know, a glass of wine drunk. It just, I found it really formulaic in print, but much, much smoother and much more natural on screen. So, you know, I found Adrian Mole exactly the same. I loved the character of Adrian Mole and the whole setup and the story and the gags. But the diary, I think it's just diary format. I can't read.
I've never heard anyone say that before. I think that's really, really interesting. I was talking to someone the other day about letters versus diaries. Now I'm going to attempt to say a word that I struggle to say out loud, the epistolary novel. I had to do that quite slowly. But how the nature of letters is you've got to tell someone something exciting. You know, every letter writer is a storyteller. Mm-hmm. But a diary in a book, you know, well, I mean, I'm the opposite in that I love a diary because it feels very nosy and very voyeuristic. But there's nothing about a diary format that compels a real or imaginary person to be interesting.
No, definitely. And I think diary entries held within the narrative of a novel work really well. But it's the repetitive nature, I suppose, of here's another diary entry. They all have the same shape, don't they? It's the same shapes, short story. And so, yeah, I'm trying to think of a diary. I like memoir very much. I'm trying to think if Down and Out in Paris and London, which is one of my favourite books and is technically a diary, whether it's written in diary form, but I don't think it is. I think it's chapters with a sort of a rough diary calendar to it, but it's not Dear Diary day after day.
When did you read that? When did you sort of find that book for the first time?
I was 17 and I was going off to live in Paris, not from London. I was going from the home counties, which isn't quite such a dramatic title. My uncle gave it to me. And it was his old copy. So again, it's a kind of battered old paperback with a ripped cover. And he said, oh, you should read this. It's really good. And I absolutely loved it. It's quite flawed. It dips off quite a lot in the second half. So the first half when he's in Paris is just exquisite. And all the detail about working in the kitchens of these revolting restaurants with cockroaches and the grease on top of the food. It's really vile, and absolutely brilliant. And him sort of down to his last sou. That's all really good. When he comes to London, it's less engaging, I think. I think a good editor might have got him to sort the pace out a little bit. But I really loved it. And I actually started writing my first novel when I was living in Paris then. I had a fairly horrific gap year in Paris where lots of things went wrong. I was working in a hotel which wasn't exactly a hotel and turned out to be a not particularly pleasant place where people rented rooms by the hour instead of by the night. But it took me quite a long time to realize that, having been brought up on a diet of faulty towers where people, you know, lived in hotels, the major and the old ladies. So the fact that these people lived in this hotel was seemed completely normal. And so I started writing my sort of, my homage, I suppose, to Down and Out in Paris and London, which I'd called, had a working title of Baguettes and Brothels. And I honestly thought it was going to be completely brilliant. And I'm glad now that I've got no idea where the floppy disks that housed that novel are, because I'm fairly certain it would not be published.
How did that come about? Did you just, you know, I mean, who does not do this when they're sort of 17 or 18, think, oh, how wonderful it would be to spend a year in Paris before I start university or start the rest of my life or whatever? Was it just that kind of impulse? Was there anything more specific?
Yeah, no, it was. I mean, I loved French and I loved France and I was desperate to go. And it was back in the time when people weren't really taking gap years. So it was quite a big deal to go off to another country. It wasn't like now where you just go off backpacking and, you know, email every few days. So my parents said, well, look, you've got to, you know, do it safely. And we went through an agency. I mean, it's ridiculous now. I look back, because we went through an agency that was advertised in some random magazine about working abroad. We knew nothing about them, gave them money to find me a placement in in the hospitality industry. And I was supposed to be paid sort of pocket money once a week and be given my accommodation and meals, and none of it happened at all. It was awful. And I lived on baguettes. I had no food at all, no money. I was far too proud to call my parents to say, look, this has gone badly wrong. You know, the sorts of clientele in this hotel are really not where you'd want me to be living. So it went very badly wrong. And it's a story for another time, but it involved the police and a court case and all sorts of things by the end. And writing was my way of taking control of a situation about which I had absolutely no control. You know, I was living in a room where there was no electricity. I was in one of the hotel rooms and my electricity had fused and they wouldn't fix it or couldn't fix it. So it was completely dark. And in the middle of the night, very drunk, very not very nice men would try and get in my room. You know, it was not a nice environment. And so I was writing my way through this, having read Down and Out in Paris and London and feeling a certain amount of affinity with our protagonist. And so if I wrote my story, I could fictionalize it and create the sort of year that I had expected to have in Paris.
Your son now, is he starting to kind of read at all beyond YA and choose things for himself and sort of find a wealth of writers? Or is he, are you still having conversations about books that sort of define what he reads?
Well, both. So he finds a lot himself. He's got a great English teacher who is recommending books all the time. And so he's just started reading The Curious Incident because his English teacher said, this is a really great book, you know, you should read that. So he's reading that. And I have just given him a book that I'm going to have to check. I've got such an appalling memory, as you've probably already worked out. I read a YA book. I don't read very much YA at all. I want to say it's called Fire or Lit. It's about a boy who takes a pipe bomb to school, and it's phenomenal. I mean, it absolutely blew me away. God, this is really going to annoy me if I can't. I'm going to have to look in my other. This is why I have to keep a journal. Do you write down what you read?
I do. I've just started doing that because otherwise I do forget.
I can't find this book, but it's brilliant anyway. So when I'd finished reading it, and isn't it ridiculous because I know who the agent is and I cannot remember the title. When I finished reading it, I said to my son, you have to read this now because I need to talk to someone about it, and I need you to be that person. So I'm quite looking forward to having that conversation. But I write down the titles now because I forget so easily. I really struggle to remember exactly what it was I liked about something. I need that little prompt. But also because I find it useful if someone says, can you recommend some books, and it might be a friend or a book club or it might be a magazine, then actually I can go straight to my journal and I know the sorts of books that, you know, that they're going to like. But I write some terrible things in it about the books that I didn't like. I would be mortified if anyone found these diaries. I'd be absolutely horrified.
You have a burn book.
Yeah, I do. It's my, yeah. I say horrific things. I shall tell you. So I say nice things like, oh, I found it, that book. Isn't that amazing? I opened up my journal at exactly the right page. It's called Last Lesson. It's not called Fire at all or Burn. Last Lesson by James Goodhand. And I've just written devastatingly brilliant. But I also write things like completely missed the mark against other people's and shallow characterization and effort to read, which is why I could never ever take these out of the house in case I lost them.
Sure, you've had this thought before, but I think that'd be amazing, talking about, you know, with them being police notebooks, sort of, you know, a swap and they get dropped and there's a confusion in all of these. See, because I mean, my worst habit, I think, is, especially if I've been sent something that's very, 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 very hyped, and it's a sort of almost like a reverse Emperor's New Clothes or something, and I'm like, am I insane? Or is this bad? I don't think this is good at all, but everyone else says it's wonderful.
Yes, that's, I find that really, really hard. And I'm very, very strict about saying nice things. I flatly refuse to quote on a book that is just okay. You know, I think it is disingenuous to give my name to something that I don't really think is brilliant. And I read a lot of good books, and I read a lot of very good books, and I quote on the very, very, very good books, you know, those ones that really made a mark. But yeah, quite often I will read something that lots of people have loved or said that they've loved. And I just think, where is the big thing? What am I missing? A little bit like when you read a book that is supposed to have a twist and you think, well, there isn't a twist, and the reason there isn't a twist for you is because you just saw that right from the start, and so there was no big reveal. But I guess that's the beauty of books, they are so subjective.
I think my English teacher when I was at secondary school said that the thing she loved about what she did and about reading was it's for everyone and you can come in at any level. With something like maths, the number of people who can enjoy that's limited. There are only so many points of entry, whereas, you know, reading, there's a book for everyone and there's a person for every book. There's always someone you can get something out of it.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. I think that's brilliant. I did a quick read recently and so have done quite a lot of prison visits and talking to a lot of people for whom reading hasn't felt very accessible, and I've really loved that because I think it's a really important reminder of the majority of people that live outside of this little bubble where you read 5 books a week.
But I do think that we are at a point where some of us are reading a lot more than before. For some of us, it's really, really, really hard to switch off from the world and to read something that isn't the news on our phone. What books would you want to gently place in the hands of someone who wants to fall back in love with reading again but is struggling at the moment?
The quick reads, without a doubt. I was looking at them this morning. So that's this lot of you know, the latest batch of quick reads. So there's a really kind of hard-bitten crime novella by A.A. Dand, which is perfect, I think, for people that love crime normally, but just don't have the capacity to focus. I mean, I'm really struggling to focus. And then, you know, Millie Johnson and short stories by J.J. Moyes and something by Candice Carty-Williams. They're so, so brilliant and they're so accessible and straightforward without being patronising. I read my first quick read when I had just had twins and was really struggling to concentrate and couldn't read and didn't have the time or the kind of mental capacity to focus on more than a few characters. And I read a quick read that I got from the library. And it was just brilliant because I had that sense of accomplishment of having finished a novel without the 450 pages. But the other novel that I would press into people's hands at the moment is one of my favourites, which is Steinbeck's Of Mice and Men, which is so tiny. And I knew it was a small book. And then I got it off my shelves this morning and thought, oh, how many pages is it exactly? And it's not even 100, it's 95 pages long. It's nothing. And there's so much in that story. There's so much loyalty and love and passion in such a simple story. And I think that's a really good one to press in people's hands as well at the moment.
Huge thanks to Claire. After the End is out now in paperback and it makes perfect lockdown reading. It's uplifting, hopeful and beautifully written. And it's a book about remembering to see the best in people, which doesn't always feel easy at the moment. I'm Daisy Buchanan. Thank you so much for listening. Your Booked is produced by Dale Shaw for New Alaska and hosted by Acast. Follow us on social media at YBooked. I hope you're all keeping as safe and sane and well and cheerful as possible. Do keep reading and we'll see you next time.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.